This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This morning, we talked with Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. He's written a new book titled The Court and the World, American Law and the New Global Realities. Breyer passionately argues in the book that when issuing its rulings these days, quote, the Supreme Court must increasingly consider the world beyond our national frontiers. But there's an obvious, immediate tension here. The court's duty is to interpret the constitutionality of American law. Therefore, Breyer's critics would say that any consideration of international issues, politics, or law subverts the primacy of the U.S. Constitution. Well, Justice Stephen Breyer has a clear response to that.
You said something very interesting, and I think those who are against using or looking at foreign law, they say this is an American constitution. We are American judges. We must preserve our American values. And the best way to do that is focus on America and what happens here. And I've tried to produce the examples I've had because I want to say I agree with you about what we're trying to do. Preserve our basic American values, rule of law, democracy, human rights. But in today's world, the best way to do that is to understand what is happening outside our own boundaries. And if we don't do that, the world will go on without us, and we will be subject to whatever they decide anyway. So it is better to participate in that, to know what goes on, to understand where we stand in respect to other countries in the world as the best way to preserve, not to undermine, our American values.
Breyer also says that the Supreme Court simply has no choice in the matter. The world is intruding upon the court. Some 20% of the cases the justices hear have an international component. So Breyer gave us an example, seemingly mundane, but in his view, emblematic. It's a 2013 case, Kurtzsang versus Wiley, that challenged how U.S. copyright law applied to domestic textbook sales.
A student who goes to Cornell, he's from Thailand, and he noticed that the books in Thailand, the very books he was using, were sold in Thailand a lot cheaper. So he wrote to his parents and said, please send me copies. And they sent copies. In fact, they sent a lot of copies, and he sold them.
All right. This is the case about banning the importation of textbooks. That's right.
Yes. And after a while, the publisher came to get a little annoyed and sued him. And the question before us in that case was whether six words in the Copyright Act applied and allowed him to do it or didn't allow him to do it. Now, I noticed a pile of briefs, probably a foot and a half thick, on that question from lawyers all over the world. I wondered why on this technical matter. And we were told, well, copyright today is a question not just of books or even films or music. It's in automobiles. After all, automobiles have software, which is copyrighted. You go into a store and you will see labels. They're all, not all, but many are copyrighted on every product you can think of. And the bottom line was, we think, said one of the briefs, that your answer in this case will affect $3.6 trillion worth of commerce. Now, that's a lot of money even today. And that's why people all over the world were filing briefs, and we couldn't answer the question in that case, a matter of American law, without knowing quite a lot about what happened abroad in terms of copyright, publishers' practices, all sorts of things.
Can you remind us how the court ended up deciding on the textbook case?
We decided in favor of the student.
Much to the relief of tens of thousands of students in the United States.
That's correct. That's correct.
Well, there's so many questions and concerns sort of embedded in the very premise of why you wrote this book. And you sort of hit them head on, because there's a section where you write that by virtue of even saying that judges should take into consideration what's happening globally, that, quote, you know, some foreign governments fear that, quote, American judges will apply an Americanized version of the law, and some Americans worry about their law becoming more internationalized. I mean, are those valid concerns?
They're valid concerns, but I think you have to look at the examples, and that's why the book is chock full of examples. The one I like is, I think it absolutely illustrates the point, is Dolly Phil Ortega. Is it all right if I tell you that for a minute?
Yes, absolutely, please.
All right. Dolly Phil Ortega comes to New York from Paraguay. She's a citizen of Paraguay in the 70s. She finds in New York another man from Paraguay, the man who had tortured her brother to death. And she also finds an old law of America passed in the 1790s, probably to help the victims of pirates. And that law says that she can get damages as a result of an injury caused in violation of the law of nations. Now that's an American statute. She won. She went back to Paraguay. And she said, I came to look that torturer in the eye, and I came back with so much more. Well, naturally, her winning led to a lot of other lawsuits by other people who were victims of other things. And now we have to begin the job of interpretation. Who are today's pirates? And more than that, suppose you have to have an interpretation of this statute. So were it to apply in other countries, and were other countries to apply their law, the president travels somewhere, and, well, you can imagine the chaos. It's got to be roughly uniform. Now, those are ordinary legal jobs. Today, they are applied through this statute to human rights violations all over the world, and there's no way to work this statute unless you figure out what's going on abroad. I can give you, my goodness. What about the problem of security in a civil war?
Right.
What about the security versus in terrorist times? Whose job is it to protect us? Not the court's job. But the courts do have responsibility for seeing that basic human rights are not infringed.
Well, and in fact, you've heard many cases on this front. I mean, you write about, for example, the Hamdi case.
What's so interesting to me about it is if you went back to Abraham Lincoln or even to World War II, you would see that the basic principle was courts, stay out of this. This is a matter for the president. It's Cicero. Cicero said when war... In time of war, when arms speak, the laws fall silent. But that turned out to work lots of harm. And now you put your finger on the result, which is that the courts have become involved in these cases, as in Guantanamo, requiring them to do a balance of the problems of human right limitation on the one hand and the problem of security on the other.
Yeah.
And my point is simply there's no way to do that today. Unless courts are willing to try to find out what the nature of the security problem is and find out what other countries do as well.
Well, let me ask you about exactly that, because you raise a very interesting question in your section on international agreements and treaties about one particular case that the court heard back in 2002, and it was an Eighth Amendment case regarding whether or not the United States should apply the death penalty in cases where the defendant was mentally disabled and whether or not that constituted cruel and unusual punishment. There was at least one amicus brief that was filed that suggested that it was cruel and unusual punishment because only the United States and Kyrgyzstan allowed this. Of course, later on, the government of Kyrgyzstan said no, they don't even allow the use of the death penalty on mentally disabled defendants. But you raise the question of whether or not it should even matter what other countries do when the justices are considering the constitutionality of U.S. law. What's your answer to that?
Well, my answer is where you're considering the death penalty, it often is a question whether its administration, or maybe the penalty itself, is consistent with the Constitution's Eighth Amendment, which forbids cruel and unusual punishments. Did the framers mean unusual in the United States, or did they mean unusual in the world? And if you look, you will find no answer. I don't know, and I haven't found out anyone who does know. So that becomes a very controversial issue, whether you should or should not look abroad in a case involving the death penalty.
But in the very existence of your book suggests that, I mean, that is the question that the justices are constantly being asked to answer.
It is in many, many cases, and it is in that one. And in that one, when I've written on the subject, I've put in a few pages just along the lines you are talking about. But that's not my only argument. And that is an argument. The people who accept it can, and the people who disagree, they can disagree. You see?
Yeah, I do. But Justice Breyer, if I may, there are many people out there, some of them are your fellow justices, who still return to the basic notion of the sanctity and the supremacy of the United States Constitution, that all the tools that the justices need lie there within. Therefore, yes, while the world is evolving and changing, the Constitution provides all that you need.
Ah, well, you see, that's rather hard to say exactly what it is that they're saying. Do you mean that we are not deciding a question of American constitutional law or American statutory law? But we are. The question is how you do it. And if, for example, we are supposed to decide whether or not in a time of terrorism the president has the power to put people, let's say, into confinement, we have to do a kind of balancing there, and that's what those four cases show. Can the president deprive such a person of access to our federal courts, the Guantanamo detainees? Can Congress do that? We said no, but if we're going to continue to decide those cases, we have to know something about the problem. The problem is a security problem. The problem is international. And it is very helpful to know what other countries, also democracies, are doing in respect to the same kind of problem. That's not denying our Constitution. That's enforcing our Constitution. It's interpreting our Constitution in light of things that are relevant, and those relevant things today are more and more things, whether it's judicial decisions or whether it's facts on the ground, that take place abroad.
Well, I'm speaking with Justice Stephen Breyer. His new book is The Court and the World, American Law and the New Global Realities. He's going to be at a Harvard Bookstore event tomorrow night. Justice Breyer, I'm curious. You are making a very powerful, fundamental assertion that the court needs to look beyond U.S. shores in order to be as informed as possible about the decisions that it makes here in the United States. Is there disagreement about your premise amongst your fellow justices?
Sometimes there is and sometimes there isn't. I think all of us agree that when we're interpreting a treaty, it's up to us to interpret the treaty. And all of us, I think when we're interpreting a treaty like that, we have to look and should look to what other countries have done by way of interpreting the same treaty.
So this is very, very fascinating because, you know, this morning I was thinking, we can talk a lot about cases that you and your fellow justices have heard, but there's also sort of the mirror image of that, you know, cases that involved Americans or American companies abroad. You know, for example, I was thinking Google and Microsoft, they have both been taken to court in Europe for various reasons, antitrust, privacy issues. So here we have two major U.S. companies whose activities were ostensibly legal in the United States, but were dragged into court in Europe. Do you and your fellow justices look at cases like that and how they play out abroad to, you know, deepen and further inform your understanding, as you were saying, about America and American jurisprudence?
Yes. For example, you mentioned antitrust. We have a case where a plaintiff from Ecuador, for example, a vitamin distributor, sues a company in Holland, Europe, a manufacturer who he says fixed prices with other manufacturers, and where does he bring the lawsuit? New York? Why? Well, maybe because we have treble damages if he wins. He gets a lot of money. But can he bring this lawsuit in New York? And that's a question of looking at the statute and how far our statutes extend and who they extend to. And you can't answer that question without understanding something about European antitrust law and how it's enforced. Indeed, outside our judicial world of the courts, the antitrust authorities in the United States in Washington and those in the European Union meet regularly, and they discuss these matters in order to have a coordinated approach, and they both filed briefs in our cases in order to make certain that our answer to a legal question reflects their need for cooperation at the administrative level. That's a very common kind of thing. We have the Bluefin Whale Commission, the International Olive Oil Council, if I've got it right, and hundreds of such organizations are in fact area by area making rules that do affect us. And the relationship between our laws and those rules is something that I believe will be the subject of lots of litigation and decision in our courts and other courts in the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when Sandra and O'Connor and I were in India at the time of 9/11, we happened to be there, it just struck me that the world is not divided geographically. It's not divided by race or religion. It's so much as it's divided between those who believe in a rule of law as for resolving our problems and those who might use more violent methods. And we're certainly on the first side.
Right. Well, Justice Breyer, if I may, I just have two brief questions to ask you before we wrap up. I know that justices have a long-held practice of not commenting on cases that may come before them in the future, but I did want to ask you about your dissent this summer in Glossop versus Gross. That was the lethal injection case, because you wrote in your dissent that the death penalty in and of itself now likely constitutes a legally prohibited, cruel, and unusual punishment. So if I may ask, Justice Breyer, I mean, is that you saying that you believe all forms of the death penalty are unconstitutional?
I was saying that because it might sometimes get the wrong person because for reasons I set out, it was typically administered, too often administered in a very arbitrary manner, that it takes 18 years where there is an execution on average, and because very, very few, ever fewer states or counties, in fact, have the death penalty, that led me to the conclusion that the court should consider the question of whether the death penalty is or is not consistent with the words I told you earlier, forbidding cruel and unusual punishments. That was what I wrote.
Well, we began this conversation by you telling us that the need to consider global realities is a major change that you've seen in your 21 years on the court. Can you tell us what you think some of the other biggest changes are that the Supreme Court has undergone since you became a justice?
Well, it's a change in personnel. And Justice White said, with every new appointment, it's a new court. And there is some truth to that. The dynamic is different. The people are different. Now, how that leads to differences in terms of results, no one can really predict.
I was just asking because it seems to me that regardless of how the justices, or the court, I should say, regardless of how the court decides on the high-profile cases, that someone out there accuses the court of being an activist one. I mean, is that just the reality of the role that the Supreme Court plays in American life today?
Well, activist is usually meant in a pejorative way.
Indeed.
what we're doing, first, we're unanimous 50% of the time about the 5-4s that you read about are probably 20% of the cases, not always the same 5, same 4 by any means. But questions where, for example, that word liberty in the 14th Amendment or the word the freedom of speech in the First Amendment. Not only do those words not explain themselves, but cases arise where the precedent and the language of the text and the language of that Constitution doesn't answer the question, and they affect a lot of people. We're the Boundary Patrol. That boundary is defined by a constitution with very open language. So no wonder the questions are difficult. I mean, is abortion inside or outside? And what about the death penalty? And what about affirmative action? What about campaign finance? When those questions come before us with the openness of the language and with the difficulty of deciding the case, it's not surprising that they are on page 1 of the Constitution because they affect a lot of people. But it's important to remember that we are just interpreting what's in that Constitution that sets boundaries, and within those boundaries there is a vast, vast area for the people through the democratic process to decide what kinds of towns, cities, states, and nations they want. That's why we have elections. And when I talk to the students, I say, oh, you don't like what's going on? Fine. You go out and vote. You participate. You convince. If you can't convince, you're not going to win. But if you convince, you convince others, you tell the others to convince others, you might get your way. That's what democracy is about. And if you don't participate at all, I can't tell you how to lead your life. But I can tell you, if you refuse to participate in your community's affairs, this document that I and others have a job of interpreting won't work. That's what Adams thought. That's what Jefferson and Madison and the others thought. They saw communities where people would participate. The Supreme Court's job is to patrol the boundary. That's not to say what this country will be like.
Well, Stephen Breyer is an associate justice on the United States Supreme Court. His new book is The Court and the World, American Law and the New Global Realities. He will be in conversation about his book tomorrow night at a Harvard bookstore event. You can find more information about that at radioboston.org. Justice Breyer, it's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you.
And Justice Breyer mentioned voting, so when we come back, we'll check in on what's happening in the New Hampshire primary. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.